This episode of The Fern Line is supported by Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Are you searching for ways to increase your mental focus in the mountains and in life? Look no further than Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Owned and operated by prolific alpinist Sam Johnson, Behind the Sun Therapeutics is a private mental health and mental coaching practice based in Seward, Alaska. Sam, who is featured on the Fernline episode Mindful Mountaineer, has made numerous first ascents spanning from Alaska, Asia, and many places in between. Sam is excited to offer performance-oriented mental coaching for risk-oriented sports to clients based around the world, as well as mental health services for clients within the state of Alaska. For more information, contact Behind the Sun Therapeutics via phone at 907-422-7504 or by email at behindthesuntherapeutics@gmail.com. The Fernline is also supported by the Alaska Rock Gym. Providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995, the Alaska Rock Gym continues its commitment to providing a great climbing experience for everyone. The Alaska Rock Gym sports over 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio, fitness, and yoga rooms. Stop by the Alaska Rock Gym to take a tour of the facility, or check them out online at alaskarockgym.com. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On each episode, I speak with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right, well, it's great to be back with you all for another episode of The Fern Line. Some quick business before we dive into the show. If you enjoy this podcast and if you want to support The Fern Line, here's a few ways you can help out. Probably the number one way to support the show is to become a monthly subscriber over on Patreon. Patreon is essentially a voluntary subscription where you can kick down a dollar amount each month, and in return, you get early access to content, stickers and music, and other bonus content as well. So if you want to help out that way, just head on over to patreon.com/thefernline and you can sign up there. Other ways to support the show are to leave a review over on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also tell someone directly. Word of mouth is the best way to get information out there, and it really helps promote the grassroots vibe I'm going for. So tell your friends, your climbing partners, people you think might dig the Fern Line, let them know it's out there. And finally, if you're looking for some Fern Line merch, like t-shirts, coffee mugs, or stickers, you can head on over to thefernline.com and visit the online store. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or limestone shale bivvy on the north face of Mount Alberta and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
Come over Wooly's shoulder, and there it is, this big black cape or spear point of a face, and it's like, holy crap. So dark and big and brooding, and when you see the face in the early morning light, as I have seen it initially, you know, that north pillar just sticks out so blatantly, and you think, man, someone's got to climb that.
On today's episode of The Fern Line, we'll delve into the first of a two-part series with Canadian Rockies legend, Barry Blanchard. Barry's name is synonymous with some of the most iconic lines in the Canadian Rockies, and his first ascents on these mythical walls are many, from the Andromeda Strain, to the North Pillar of North Twin, to a gutsy climb on Mount Kefren called the Wild Thing, and a visionary line of beauty up Mount Robson's Emperor Face. But like many alpinists, Barry's career has been defined just as much by strong partnerships and friendships he's forged than by the mountains themselves. And this was especially evident during a recent conversation we had. We talked about everything from his early experiences in the Rockies to a string of ascents in the early to mid 80s with Dave Cheesemond, and much, much more. We started our conversation by talking about Barry's formative experiences as a kid and how those experiences would lead to, as Barry writes in his book, The Calling, a life rocked by mountains.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Calgary, Alberta, and I'm the eldest of five, and basically raised by a single mom who is, you know, our family lineage is Métis, which is mixed blood culture here in Canada. So if I'd have been born 200 years ago, I would have hunted buffalo off horseback. And that's the way the Métis made their living for a number of hundred years. So crossbreeding between native gals, basically, and French and Scottish fur traders birthed this unique culture in Canada. And growing up in Calgary with a single mom meant that, we grew up on social assistance, welfare, so we were very, very poor. And yeah, I think one of the things that was really lacking in my young life was any really strong kind of male role modeling, which is, you know, critically important for young guys.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, all young guys want to be heroes. So I had to look around and try to, you know, me and my buddies had to look around and try to create heroic models for ourselves. And, you know, astronauts and, race car drivers, mountain climbers are maybe the templates for a lot of that.
Right.
So, yeah, I started getting interested in mountain climbing before, I even had a concept of what a mountain climber was. But that interest and being read to on a Greyhound bus when I was 9 years old from passages from the White Spider by a gal in her 20s who was a climber who just happened to be sitting next to me on this Greyhound bus ride and took the time to read to me from the White Spider really was a strong call and an attraction to me as a young guy. And I got interested in the, you know, writing of literature of climbing and started reading it in high school and then really started to get a strong call and desire to get out and do some climbing. Yeah.
So what was your first actual experience going out and climbing?
It was in high school. It was probably in, grade 11. My buddy had taken a rock climbing course, a weekend rock climbing course, and bought some gear. And then his brother was a climber who, you know, lent him a rack and a rope. So me and my buddy went out to a place in the Kananaskis region of Alberta called Wasatch Slabs. It's actually a Stony Nakota word that means unique and describes a really unique tower that sits above Wasatch Creek. But my buddy, you know, had taken the course, so he started up one of the routes we saw that we thought we might be able to get up, and he got about 30 feet up and got gripped out of his skull and came down as a quivering amoebic blob of non-confidence. And I said, yeah, let me try. And, you know, I'd read Royal Robin's Advanced Rockcraft and Basic Rockcraft at that time and practiced a bunch, you know, rappelling out of the window, second story window of our condo and our townhouse, and practicing on the rafters in the basement, the stringers, you know, aid climbing. So I knew actually how a climbing system worked before, you know, I ever actually tied into a rope to actually try to climb real rock. And I tied in, and an hour and a half of battle and clinging and figuring out stuff on the lead, including protecting, saw me to the top of the 100-foot high cliff. And yeah, for the next 2 years, I just led everything and basically learned to climb by leading, which sounds really exotic in this day and age.
Right.
But back in the 70s was actually not all that uncommon.
Right.
And yeah.
So was there a turning point or like a light bulb moment when you kind of realized that climbing and I guess alpinism was going to be the driving force in your life?
Yeah. And that happened in Chamonix, actually, in 1980. My first guy I ever got kind of tied into a rope with, who was probably about the third or fourth guy I ever got tied in a rope with, who could lead better than I could and was a better climber than me, was Kevin Doyle. And we committed to each other after a season of climbing here in the Rockies, both on rock and ice and alpine climbing, that we would quit our jobs and go to Chamonix and, you know, camp illegally in the forest and climb as much as we could over a summer and stay in Europe climbing and touring around till our money ran out. And at the end of our season in the Alps, we managed to get up the north face of Les Droits, which was, you know, pretty much took everything I knew about climbing at that time and then asked for more. And Kevin and I came up with it. And when we got back into our campsite in the BOLA on the edge of Chamonix, yeah, we were lean and hard. And I don't know, I just said, okay, this is what I want to do with my life. And that was the point.
That's awesome. It actually seems like Kevin, you know, is one of your longest and most important partnerships that you've ever had. I mean, can you talk about like back in the day, like when you first met him and you describe him as being a stronger climber than you, like what was it about Kevin that like that kind of drew you to him?
Oh, his spirit. You know, it was pretty obvious from, you know, meeting him from the very first time that we were both two young guys who really, really, you know, had a lot of motivation and desire and wanted to climb. Climbing was, you know, incredibly important to us. And then from the very first time that I went out with him, which was just going bouldering at a, you know, 10 meter high boulder in southern Alberta, you know, he was just, you know, such a better climber than me. And then over the next year coming to realize and over the next decade, getting in contact with a lot of other climbers, some of whom were the, you know, the best climbers in the world, that, you know, Kevin was, he was gifted at birth. God touched him when he was born and said, okay, you get this sense of balance and body position in the vertical, that, you know, it's going to take your buddy Barry, you know, 300-500 days of imitating and following to try to, you know, catch up to. And he got that at birth. So,
right.
Yeah, one of the great things about having climbed with Kevin is to have seen that kind of gift expressed up on the sides of mountains and rock faces that, this guy was, you know, he's special. He was born a genius to climbing genius, and he refined it and put a lot of effort and time into it. But pretty remarkable to see that.
Well, that's powerful. It's funny, like reading The Calling, it just kind of the way you describe Kevin and just thinking about like how old you guys were then. It's funny because like I see myself, and you know, I only had a couple of like really strong partners like that. But you know, your relationship with Kevin kind of reminds me of one of my friends, and it's kind of the same thing where it's like, you feel like you could go do anything with that person. You know, you feel like, well, if I can't do it, I know that he can. And it kind of sounds like that's what you had with Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah. We, man, we know spent 200 days a year climbing together for, you know, it's several years, 3, 4, 5 years. And, yeah, you get to know a guy pretty good. And, yeah, my book, The Calling, Greg Crouch described it as largely a bromance to Kevin.
Yeah.
Well, it's, which there, is.
Yeah. There's which that is. One, there's a one passage in there where you guys are talking about you're in a bivvy. I don't know if it's on Nanga Parbat or might be on another peak, but you're like spooning with Kevin and you guys are kind of like joking around with each other. And I think it was your buddy Ward. He says, man, you guys are weird.
Yeah. Yeah, that was on the on the Nanga Parbat trip, but on a peak across the way that we chose to use as a climatization trip, Nigiri Peak.
Right.
And yeah, no bivvy gear. We had Insulite pads, you know, I don't know where we were, 20,000 feet or something, and having to, you know, we had a stove, but we had to sit on the bivvy pads overnight. So yeah, Kevin and I are fully spooning each other, rubbing each other's back, and hugging each other. And Ward's kind of retreated to his end of the bivvy pad and sitting there shivering in the, you know, the far reaches of hypothermia, like, you guys are weird. Click, 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 click.
Right. Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, but back to, you know, the thing you could do anything with certain partners with. It was always interesting to me with Kevin that, you know, he would crash at times and bonk and, you know, just hit the I don't know what you want to call it, the low point of his biorhythms or, you know, starvation, sugar crash, whatever, but he's not able to do much. And at those times, I seem to be able to come on to some strength and carry the partnership forward. And I think there's a really interesting kind of synchronization with that stuff in a in an important climbing partnership where, you know, one guy's strong when the other guy's weak, and then it goes through a wave pattern where those things are opposed and your wave's cresting while possibly your buddy's wave is troughing. So yeah, interesting.
Although Barry's early experiences in Yosemite in the Alps lit the fire for a life defined by alpinism, it was a series of bar-setting alpine routes in the Canadian Rockies in the early and mid-80s that would cement Barry's place as one of North America's preeminent alpinists. One of those climbs was the Andromeda Strain, a mythical line on Mount Andromeda's north wall that had repelled numerous attempts by some of North America's finest alpinists. Barry would go on to make the first ascent of the route in 1983, but maybe the most important takeaway from the whole experience was his emerging partnership with another Canadian alpinist, the South African transplant, David Cheesemond. Most days we're doing all right. I come alive with you across the great divides. Here I go.
You know, it was weird to go on a route that already had a name. And I asked Jim Elzinga, you know, why is it called the Andromeda Strain outside of the obvious kind of answer that it's on Mount Andromeda. But he was, you know, he'd been up there, I don't know how many times trying to crack the route. And he said, well, it's become such a strain that we call it the Andromeda Strain.
Nice.
And then it had the echo in the movie and the book also. But yeah, a lot of the, you know, Jeff Lowe had been up there and, God, just a lot of people had been up there. Some of the best alpinists of, you know, that generation had gone up and no one had been able to crack the Andromeda Strain yet. Rusty Bailey and, you know, all these folks, John Lachlan. Yeah, I got quite keen on it. And, James Blench and I went up and made an attempt, made it halfway, came down, put in a bunch of wrap anchors, and then Dave Cheeseman came with a partner and pulled all our wrap anchors on the way up, thinking, you know, la-ti-da, we're going to the top and we've got Barry's wrap anchors. These would be so good. Because Dave was South African, and then he failed, so he put them all in the way down. And then I went back with Kevin Doyle, and we went up and pulled all Cheeseman's anchors. And, yeah. Who? And we hadn't met David yet, so it was like we heard of this really hot climber had shown up, and we were the young tigers, and you know, well, how good is this guy? You know,
right?
Chest thumping. So we pulled out all the anchors, and then we failed and put all the anchors in on rappel, but we kind of got around the corner and figured out where the key to the route lie. This chimney pitch that Kevin went up and tried to go direct and actually got in a very scary, potentially lethal fall situation and got out of it. And we put all the wrap anchors in on the way down. And then Dave went with another partner and pulled all the wrap anchors, then failed and went down. So wow. Put them all back in. So Dave and I decided on the third attempt, we'd team up together. And Tim Friesen was able to come to one of our strong climbing buddies. And on the third attempt, over 2 days, we were able to get up, and I got to do the crux chimney pitch, and I put 2.5 hours into it the first day and another 2.5 hours into it the second day. And I remember after the first day of spending, you know, 2.5 hours gaining 80 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. And using everything I knew, you know, I was mixed climbing, aid climbing, free climbing, risking a fall a lot of the time, but managing to stay in there and get it done. And I came down and my mind was just like burnt toast. I was fried, and I was pretty much spent. And I got into this big snow cave that Dave had dug. I shouldn't say big. It was long. It was a torpedo tube that he'd shoveled out into this, you know, snow mushroom that was somehow clinging to a 45-degree ice face below and an overhanging rock face above. So of course, like always, we slept anchored in with our harnesses on and tied in. But I got into the snow cave and I'm just like, oh man, I don't know if I can do this tomorrow. God, I think I'm spent. And Dave's like, oh, Barry, here, have some minestrone soup. In the morning, it will always look better. It always looks better, man, in the morning. And it worked, you know, had a good night and got up there in the morning and was ready for more and spent the next 2.5 hours and got us into the upper couloir. And then the rest was pretty magic. And Tim got to lead that iconic exit pitch of the upper gully where you're traversing to this, like this jade, massive jade kind of pendant hanging on the wall.
Right. That is that's the classic Andromeda Strain photo for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And no humans had ever sunk their picks in that chunk of jade before. And we got to do it, and soon after we were standing on the summit, and I remember writing that, you know, all around me were beautiful, beautiful mountains, and I was with good friends, and right then life was really good.
Right. That's incredible. I didn't realize that it had been attempted that many times. I mean, there must have been a mysticism around that route.
Yeah. No, it was the strain. And, you know, you'd get up to this halfway ledge by traversing out right and then traversing back. And, you know, there was an off-width there, and, you know, Lachlan had seen the off-width and gone up into it and decided the way forward was to go back down. And this is such a Canadian solution, because how do you protect an off with in the Alpine, right? There were big bros or big cams back then. So he was going to cut 1 foot lengths of hockey stick and torque them sideways into the crack and aid off the hockey stick. It was so Canadian.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You can't make that shit up, man.
I know. No, you need the theme to Hockey Night in Canada, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Aiding off cammed hockey sticks.
That was the idea. But the solution was around the corner. And actually in 87... couple other guys were able to, Joe McKay and Greg Golovach, hook up the direct pitch to the chimney. And Actually, in 2006, I went back with Johnny Blitz and Bill Belcourt and did the direct, and it was a really super fine addition to the route. Although it had been climbed previously by El Zynga, actually, and he had seen the chimney, but just never been able to get up into it.
Wow. So, yeah. Kind of getting off on a tangent here, but is that a route that is, I mean, is it climbed every year now, or will it go seasons without being climbed?
I think it gets climbed every year. Seasonally, yeah, you know, rarely in summer. People shouldn't go there in summer. It's probably far too dangerous. It's very much a winter route. How much longer it will be there is a good question, because in my 23-year absence, you know, when I was in the upper couloir, it was easy to appreciate that probably 2 meters of ice depth had been lost over those 23 years.
Wow.
And then, of course, the easy thing to appreciate is the narrowing of the width of the ice. That's the easy dimension to say, oh, wow, this used to be wider. But to look up on the wall and see old wrap anchors that are now untouchable and are, you know, 10 feet up the wall, is to realize that, holy crap, you know, 6 feet of ice of 6 or 8 feet is melted back from the surface. So the third dimension, you know, length and width are easy to appreciate, but depth, that's the one that is so shocking to see.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty wild, to think about how the mountains are changing so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it, you know, is very much a couloir route, and, ice in the lower couloir. You know, in 2013 or 2006 was just narrowed down so much. And really, it's probably a seasonal formation now, a lot of it. But you think of things like the North Face of the Eiger, where the second ice field just doesn't exist anymore. And it becomes a compact neve snow feature in the wintertime that allows people to climb it. You know, without anywhere near the amount of security you can get if you're sinking ice screws in ice. But, you know, it still is, I think, a really good, enjoyable climbing experience for people in the wintertime, the North Face of the Eiger. Yeah.
Well, I did want to talk to you about Dave Cheesemond. You know, obviously, you know, in my mind, like, he's still a force in the alpine climbing community in North America, and obviously in Canada. How did you guys, it sounds like the Andromeda Strain was your first climb together, but like, how did you guys eventually meet? And maybe just go ahead and talk about the trajectory of your guys' friendship and partnership.
Yeah, like I say, I saw Dave and his buddies in the valley in 1981. And we were down there climbing, you know, Mug Stumps was in the valley, and Backer and Kauk, and, you know, all these legends of climbing. And Dave was there with three of his South African buddies, and they had just survived their starvation event on Mount Deborah, where, you know, they almost starved to death.
Right.
Because they didn't. They got flown in there, and then their food didn't get flown in there, and they ended up walking out over the tundra to get back to the highway and, you know, lost, I don't know, 40% of their body weight or something.
God.
Ridiculous. But, yeah, I remember seeing this wild van down in the valley. And then the next year, Dave immigrated to Calgary as he was a PhD engineer. And, you know, it's kind of funny, when he got his PhD, they said, you know, oh, are you coming to the awards ceremony? And Dave said, well, do I get the PhD if I don't show up? And they said, oh, yes, you have your PhD. And he said, well, I'm going to climb Mount Kenya again. So, you know, y'all have a good time. You know, so that's where Dave was at. And when Dave was in Africa, he climbed Mount Kenya 17 times.
Wow.
And had done so much by the time he showed up in Calgary. He'd had an extended season in several seasons down in the Andes, climbed Fitzroy with the Burgess twins. And, you know, one season he told me he had dug I don't know, 20 snow caves just in his season alone in the Andes. So the guy was he was the real deal. He was an animal. He just loved to climb and wanted to climb and knew so much about it that he was a godsend when he came into Calgary, and very soon became dear friends with Urs Kalen, kind of our Yoda of the Canadian Rockies. Urs clued Dave into a lot of the big faces in the Rockies that, you know, didn't have lines on them. And the first time that Dave and I put a line together on one of those faces was the Andromeda strain. And that was, a year after having met him for the first time, though. And the first time that Kevin and I met Dave was at the Calgary Mountain Club's weekly kind of meeting at the bar. And it was by then the Unicorn, because when I got involved with the Calgary Mountain Club, often called a drinking club with a climbing problem,
right,
was in the days when we used to drink in the Cecil, which was one of the roughest bars in Calgary. And sure enough, there was a murder there one night. So we moved from the Cecil to the Unicorn. So one Wednesday night, Kevin and I went down the stairs and met Dave, and he had soloed the Cassine in 81, and Kevin and I were going in 82. So Dave sat down with us with a map and shared a whole bunch of information about the Cassine with us, including taking his pencil and pointing it down to the airstrip and saying, "Right, the first place I ever put on skis was here."
Nice.
And he skied off to the Cassine.
Yeah.
Him and Michael Kennedy played hopscotch, soloing up the Cassine together, you know, passing each other, shaking hands, talking. I think they shared their tent up high for a night or two. So, yeah, pretty cool. And, it was obvious pretty soon into our climbing that Dave was an amazing rock climber and developing ice climber. And Kevin and I were pretty good ice climbers at that point, and pretty good rock climbers too. And Dave just knew how to take all of that kind of ambition and talent and orchestrate it on the side of a mountain to come up with these routes up these faces in the Rockies. And it was an amazing time. You know, a lot of the faces hadn't been climbed. And there we were. Yeah, time to go get after them and get some of them done.
With their bond cemented on the Andromeda strain, Barry and David looked for their next objective in the Canadian Rockies. That challenge came in the spring of 1984, when the duo, accompanied by Alaskan alpinist Carl Tobin, skied into the base of Mount Fay's east face. Over the next 3 days, the trio encountered extremely difficult rock and ice climbing and were pounded by a storm up high, before finally staggering to the top of the face. I asked Barry to talk about that climb and to share some of his best memories from that experience.
Last night I was driving, thinking to myself, I was off in the distance, far away from everyone else. There was a light on the highway, showing me the way to a place.
Yeah, I remember being in our house in Canmore at the time, and Dave and I had come back from climbing. It was after the Andromeda strain. I think we'd been out ice climbing or rock climbing or something. And he was becoming a good friend. And he actually invited me to head off to Mount Deborah with he and Carl. But I just couldn't afford it. I needed to go tree planting just to keep my life, have enough to eat, basically.
Right.
Yeah. I had to say no to going to Mount Deborah. Yes to going tree planting.
Right.
What a great decision that was. Right. I guess it kept me out of the poorhouse. But God, to have gone to Deborah with Dave and Carl, oh man, God. Yeah, it's like,
what a brilliant climb that was.
Yeah. Fantastic. And then, you know, Carl came down the next winter to spend all winter here, basically climbing with us here in the Rockies. And, you know, Dave introduced me to Carl, and, you know, we soon got out, and it was so cool meeting Carl, because he'd actually been in the Valley in 81 too. And I remember him, although I think I got to chat with him a bit, but, you know, kind of in passing.
Right.
And to see him here in the Rockies, and then to start doing stuff with him and going to the gym with him, and just seeing what an absolute animal the man was.
Yeah.
Because I was around some fit guys, and I was pretty darn fit.
Yeah.
But Carl was an Olympian.
Right.
You know, he was. Right. He was an animal. He was like, if you saw him without his shirt on, he looked like Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan just walked off the page.
Right.
You know, and not the big, inflated, bulky, steroid, you know, enhanced muscles of a bodybuilder.
Right.
But these flat, powerful plates of muscle
right.
that could do amazing things. And then to boot, the anaerobic ability, or the aerobic ability, probably anaerobic too, right. that, you know, I wasn't to see again until I started climbing probably with Alex Lowe.
Right.
That, you know, Carl get on his mountain bike and ride to Talkeetna from Anchorage.
Right.
I mean,
right.
who does that kind of thing? Carl Tobin does that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because I know, you know, back in the, around that time in the early 80s, you know, he had been, that was when people really started to climb ice in Valdez. And I know Carl was one of the people doing that. And these are, I mean, as you know, those are, you know, when it comes to waterfall ice climbing, I mean, that place is a mecca. And, you know, so I'm sure that when he showed up in the Rockies, you know, he brought his ice climbing skills, and, you know, brought his alpine climbing skills from the Eastern Alaska Range. It's cool to hear those stories about Carl. You know, some of the funny things that stand out from my interview that I did with Carl, we talked about the East Faces. You know, he chuckled. He had this one memory of you where you're kind of up on this pitch and you just kind of calmly look down and ask him and Dave, any suggestions?
Yeah. I remember that pitch for sure.
And then of course, there's also, you know, the story of Carl up on this overhanging vertical pillar, and he basically looks down at you guys and says, I'm going to jump.
I know. Yeah. No, it was a huge adventure from the get-go, you know, typical Cheeseman logistics, you know. Right. Carl and I will show up in the van on Friday night. We'll pick you up in Canmore. We'll drive out to the Moraine Lake Parking Trailhead, and we'll get on our skis, and we will ski the 12 miles into Moraine Lake through the night. We will get to the shelter. We will sleep for several hours. We will leave one set of skis there. Then we will ski over to the East Face, and we will climb it in 2 days and come down, get our first set of skis, and ski out, and I will be at work on Monday morning.
And good God.
Carl will ski in to get our other skis below the face during the week. So, yeah, that was the plan. But yeah, so first part of the plan all works out okay. And yeah, you know, the pitch that I asked for suggestions was just a brocade, a wall hanging of tassels of ice, and just trying to find enough to get up this, you know, vertical wall. And when I was asking for suggestions, I was trying to figure out how to deal with a chunk of ice the size of my thigh, and like how I'm going to get up it. And I didn't get many suggestions outside of, you should go up, Barry. Yeah, go up, man, go up. Go for it, Bubba. Yeah, I was able to tie off the chunk of ice the size of my thigh and sink an ice screw, couple threads, and tie it off, and convince myself that that would hold me if I fell. So I went up there, and then we traversed over to the sapphire blue pillar that was just so beautiful. And, you know, Dave and I think we had a couple pitons in on our ice axes, pounded into the snow to make an anchor. And Carl went up there and he started up the pillar, and you know, he started breathing really heavily, and Dave and I are watching, and Dave's like, yes, yeah, man, they haven't made a piece of ice that Carl cannot climb. And Carl's starting to tremble, and it's like, oh my God. And then, you know, he's really trembling, and he's breathing at his max, and he looks down to Dave and I, goes, I can't hang on, I'm gonna jump. And Dave and I are like, jump! You can't fucking jump! What do you mean jump? You can't fucking jump! And we look at the ice axes behind the snow and the pitons, and suddenly Carl jumps off. He leaves his ice tools in the ice and jumps off and like falls, I don't know, 20 feet through the air and lands on this snow mushroom beside the ice climb that he aimed for, and it didn't break, and that was a miracle, and he stuck it like a dismount for a parallel bars routine. It was absolute superhero shit. I mean, he and stuck it and didn't die, and we didn't die.
Yeah.
So he comes back to us somehow, and Dave looks at me and he goes, right then, now it's your turn, Barry.
Oh my God.
I get up there, and the only reason I was able to get up the pitch is I was able to clip into Carl's tools and hang and sink a screw and then, you know, clip them as protection, continue on, get up a bit higher and be in the same situation, you know, breathing like a locomotive, trembling, and was able to hang off my tools and put in a screw and get over the top. And, yeah, that was the first, second day after skiing through the night, first day on the face.
Man.
Then the next day we got hit by a collapsing snow mushroom, and I got my shoulder really badly bruised, and I was out of leading, but I got to watch Carl and David and their partnership just do their magic, and did a lot more good climbing. And yeah, I got really super cold, and it started to storm, and we had a hard night, and me getting hypothermic. And then the next day we're traversing across these snow slopes, and it's storming and the avalanche hazard's escalating and snow's sliding all over. And I'm pretty pissed off with the situation and just basically pitch a hissy fit, as we're crossing these snow slopes, and turn out and start screaming and swearing profanity at the storm. And Carl catches up to me, and I'm out of breath and folded over my ice axes, just panting. He comes up to me and he goes, hey man, it don't got to be fun to be fun. And he just keeps going towards David. And I'm like, yeah, it don't got to be fun to be fun.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, continued on. And that night in the snow cave, our third night on the wall, you know, we had a box of Smarties left. And I knew I was with really hard, cool guys because we split the Smarties, 17 Smarties apiece. And they didn't even insist on more red ones. I had more red ones than anybody else.
Nice.
And they let me have the red ones.
Nice.
So, cool guys.
What an experience, man.
Yeah. Great route. Hard, trying route. Definitely some good luck in that, you know, when the snow thing collapsed, the avalanche that hit us, none of us got taken out, like swept off the face.
Right.
And my bruised shoulder blade was about the worst. We had to deal with that.
And and Carl's dismount, perfectly landed dismount. I mean, that's just like you can't make that shit up.
No,
like
no, you can't. You can't. Hollywood does do it, but they need cables and stunt guys and all this control. Carl just did it. He was a superhero.
It's unbelievable. That is unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, it gets better because we get off the face the next day. We get over to the hut, the Neil Colgan hut. And I'm like, guys, there's always a ton of food in these huts. We get there. There's one kind of little date square about the size of a box of matches. And that's what we split. And then we head off down the 3-4 couloir. We get to Moraine Lake and we don't have skis. The other skis are over at the cook shelter. And there's over a meter of snow penetration, like over a yard. So Dave goes out front. He has size 12 feet and he weighs like 150 pounds. So he's like Legolas out there. He's walking on top of the snow. And Carl and I are up to our waist. So we're like, fuck you, Cheeseman, get behind us. So the way we work it out is Carl lifts me up by the waist and pushes me onto the surface of the snow. And I plunge my next foot into the snow and we repeat. for a half a mile across the lake.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah.
Wow.
Dave was late for work when he showed up on Wednesday morning.
It's interesting how certain mountains can be defining benchmarks in your life. This was certainly the case for Barry when he and Dave Cheesemond walked over Woolly's Shoulder in late July 1985, intent on climbing the unclimbed North Pillar on the brooding north wall of North Twin. Rising nearly 5,000 feet and shaped like an obsidian arrowhead, the north wall of North Twin was, and still is, one of the most feared and imposing faces in the Canadian Rockies. When George Lowe and Chris Jones made the first ascent of the face in 1974, it was easily one of the hardest alpine climbs ever done in North America, if not the world. So when Barry and Dave started up the North Pillar in those dog days of summer, they carried a deep respect for the mountain and an undeniable trust in each other. I asked Barry to talk about this life-changing experience on North Twin, what his partnership with Dave meant to him, and how the legacy of Dave lives on in the climbing community today.
Holding steady through the changes all around you, I'm never far behind, 'cause we got things we need to do. There's stormy weather blowing through. Can't imagine losing you, my dear friend.
Yeah, I think it was such a mythical thing for me. And I think because, you know, the first ascent by Chris Jones and George Lowe had just the story that was written about it, the images that appeared in Ascent, just, you know, spoke so loudly to me. And the first time I saw the North Face of North Twin, which is not easy to see, you know, you got to put in a solid half or one day of pretty rugged travel just to see the face. You know, you come over Woolly's Shoulder and there it is, this big black cape or spear point of a face, and it's like, holy crap, so dark and big and brooding. And when you see the face in the early morning light, as I have seen it initially, you know, that North Pillar just sticks out so blatantly and just such a beautiful linear feature that you think, man, someone's got to climb that. And I saw it on the way into the North Face of Mount Alberta, actually. And so another George Lowe route. And, you know, had my mind blown on the North Face of Alberta by George's route, basically.
Right.
And then for the next couple years, just trained and thought and had a picture of North Twin up, you know, in my trailer in Canmore, and looked at it all the time and thought, you know, Dave and I talked about North Twin. And then it got really scary, you know, before our planned ascent to go in there in 1985, because George Lowe and Alex Lowe showed up to go try the face. And, you know, George had called Dave before, they're good friends, and he's like, yeah, me and Alex are going to come up and go take a look at the pillar on Twin. And Dave's like, oh, man, George, I've been thinking about that route for 5 years, man. And George's like, yeah, geez, I've been thinking about it for 20. Yeah. So, in went George and Alex, and thankfully they, as is hard to say about your buddies, it rained the whole time.
Right.
So they walked past North Twin and went climb Mount Columbia in the rain. It came out in the rain.
Nice.
So Dave and I got to go in there in the dog days of summer and have our ascent on the North Face of North Twin, which was, you know, big, initially very scary to get onto the face with the amount of rockfall that was coming down. It's interesting to talk to John Walsh, and Oh man, his partner Josh Wharton, after they got off the face, because they went in the first week of September, they didn't have any rockfall on the lower part of the mountain, whereas Dave and I were dodging. It was like a beach landing in the Second World War. You know,
what time of year? When was that? Was it July?
It was the last days of July and the first days of August.
Okay.
So some of the hottest days of the year, but right. You want to have the pillar, the North Pillar, at least pretty free of snow. So you can, you know, free climb as hard as you can on rock. Or you do something that is also sensible, and that's to go when it's in winter conditions, like Marco Presel and Steve House did.
Right.
But they didn't end up climbing on the pillar. I think the pillar would be very, very challenging, you know, in winter conditions. But you know, I snapped a tendon in my ring finger on the second day of the climb, cranking, you know, on some 5'10" with my size 8 feet and Dave's size 10 rock shoes, which didn't climb all that well.
Right.
But we took one pair of rock shoes to save on weight. So yeah, I ended up having a tendon pop because of that. But yeah, then Dave did most of the hard rock climbing after that, and it was just pitch after pitch of, you know, and he was a genius. And especially on loose, serious rock climbing, and there's no shortage of that on North Twin.
Right. So is it likewise? Is North Twin is it limestone or quartzite?
It's limestone. Pretty much all shale and limestone. I don't know. I don't remember any quartzite really on the peak at all. I don't think there is any quartzite on North Twin.
Right. Well, there's the one picture in your book, which to me it's just embedded in my mind of Dave leading that just beautiful, clean corner that's seeping wet, but it's just this stunningly beautiful pitch up there.
Yeah. Splitter laser cut limestone. Just, you know, probably a 400 or 500 foot band of immaculate limestone.
So did you guys see, I'm just like geeking out here because I love talking about climbing, but did you guys see that feature from the ground? Did you know you were heading to it, or did you just stumble upon that crack?
Well, you know, when you're sprinting up the stuff below it, trying to dodge rockfall, you're looking at that band and you know it's the first really challenging band of the face, and you want to get to it because when you're up against it, then the rockfall is way out behind you, so you're relatively safe. And it is, you know, it's literally picking which splitter looked the best, looked the driest, and, you know, the best, easiest to climb. And that was the one. And it's not like we didn't have a choice. There was probably three or four splitters just like that. And we're that cliff, you know, roadside without all the, you know, 4,000 feet of alpine terrain above it that has glaciation and snow and ice and all that kind of stuff feeding water down to it. Were it dry, you know, it's Verdon limestone. It's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it would be the greatest climbing in the Canadian Rockies for a rock climber.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, take yourself like kind of back to like being on that route. And, you know, obviously the wild thing about the Rockies and especially the North Face North Twin is it's, you know, one pitch, you know, you're groveling gingerly up, you know, down sloping, you know, 65, 70 degree just total choss. And then the next pitch, you can be in a splitter like that. I mean, am I wrong?
No, that's the way it alternates, you know. Limestone strata alternated with shale, and the shale is often the horrid stuff, and often just terrifying to pull off of relatively solid limestone, although limestone can be very, very loose also.
Right.
But it's more vertical, so you're pulling onto these 45 degree bands of shale and basically trying to, you know, pinch enough encyclopedia books or LPs to cantilever up on. And you know, if you pull out on them really hard, they're just going to come out.
Right.
So it's it can be really spooky. Now, once you're on those bands, then it's just kind of monotonous, inconvenient, hassle climbing, just going up you know, trying to, it's like slate roofs in Britain, you know, a steeple roof made out of slates, trying to make your way up that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And then get anchored to the next solid band of limestone, a relatively solid band of limestone.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's not easy. You know, it's complicated stuff. It's not granite, you know, and I've climbed a lot of granite and God, the anchoring in granite is often just so, granite climbers will hate to hear this, but so black and white, so monochromatic, so easy to come up with bomber anchors with few pieces. And limestone's just not like that. It's pretty three-dimensional, it's complicated, and it takes a number of pieces. And to think of doing those kind of things without the knife blade piton is impossible.
but to you, I mean, isn't that the kind of the appeal of the adventure of the Canadian Rockies?
A lot of it, yeah. And a lot of why we tended to focus on winter, because the shale bands are covered with snow and they often provide places where you can get a snow cave. And then a lot of the loose limestone is locked up with frost. So it provides a really, actually a good solid climbing medium. Whereas in the summer, it can be, the frost is gone and it's can be really spooky climbing bookshelves. Basically, you know, you grab the wrong volume of the book and it's coming out in your hand. So there's a lot of skill and nerve and cunning to it. And then a lot of skill to try to keep it reasonably safe. And I do enjoy that mental challenge. Although at any one point, if I'm in a choss band and I'm really worried about falling and getting hurt, if not killed, if you had a, you know, Mr. Wizard, take me away, I'd probably say, yes, please, Mr. Wizard, take me away. Yeah. But you hold it together and you get up them.
Right.
Yeah.
Getting back to that climb on North Twin, the interesting thing about that route for you, doing it in the summer, is that you guys found caves to sleep in.
Yeah, we found one the night that we needed it, kind of right at the base of the pillar where, you know, a lot of the lower half of the face is vertical bands interspersed with the 45 degree shale bands and even some ice climbing. But then you get on the pillar and it does go to vertical and overhanging basically. And it was wild to watch the curtains of raindrops, water drops. They're not rain, they're melting off the upper face, but they're 200 feet out in the air behind you in these, you know, sunlit curtains. It's really beautiful, but it's just so steep up there. And the night we got a storm, you know, we happened upon this natural cave. And, you know, I was coming up and Dave was hooting and hollering and shouting up there. And I got up, what is it, man? Look over there, man. You have to go check that out. I think it is a cave, man. So I go check it out. And sure enough, it's this cave. We can put the bibbler up in there, hang it from a cam in the ceiling, have enough anchorage. There's ice and snow on the floor to melt for water that night. And we're in there in our little kind of mosquito net hung bibbler because we can't put the poles up in it. And that night, thunder and lightning and hail and all that kind of crap goes on out there. We look out our little, you know, small portal into the cave and it looks like, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein out there, like just going off, and we're snug as bugs in a rug. And yeah, pretty darn cool.
What is, I mean, I know it was a long time ago, but it sounds like you have really vivid memories, you know, from all your trips, but that trip in particular. Like, I mean, can you describe what it felt like to be committed on that face?
Well, it's, it is commitment. You know, at a certain point, you know, in your mind, you kind of know that you don't have anywhere enough gear to get down. If you had to retreat, you wouldn't be able to do it. Although Ian and Chris, you know, Ian Wellstad got his shoulder broken by a rock fall on the pillar, and Chris was able to, you know, traverse them to the side and come down the side, so there probably is an escape. But in your mind up there, you realize, you know, when you look down, we don't have anywhere enough gear to retreat this, and there's no way they can rescue us from here. you know, they just can't do it. A helicopter, you can't do it. It's overhanging, and it's overhanging for too long. So if they were trying to rescue us, they'd have to down cable from the top and try to keep themselves tacked in. So basically rescue isn't an option. So it is really, really committing. And then, you know, when you have scary things, like we had a partial anchor failure at one point where I was Jumar-ing and got dropped 10 feet onto my Jumars, which we all know Jumars will cut ropes if you drop too far on them, and you'll start to whistle down the rope having cut the sheath, and you're going to be whistling along the core. And it gets very, very terrifying to be that committed. But then you pull it together and you look around, and it's just such a wild place. It's so wild. You know, those curtains of raindrops and glaciers calving off to your side, and the black hole down there, you know, just so shadowed and dark. And then my buddy David just coming up with these leads, lead after lead. How hard was it? 10A, man. How was that one? Oh, man, that was 10C. What was that one? It's like 10, probably 10B, 10B, man, 10B. And he just keeps doing them lead after lead. And then the very last lead on the face, you know, we're 5 days into our adventure. And if we don't get up this next 100 or 50 meters, we're going to have to retreat. And it all comes down to him going around the corner. I can't see him. Watch me, man. Watch me. I'm going to fall, man. I'm going to fall. And I'm, you know, oh, my God, don't fall. And then goes on. The rope goes out. And then, you know, oh, I'm secure. Oh, I'm belay. So I Jumar up over the apex, you know, where it all changes angle. And, you know, there's rocks bouncing down around the absolutely cello string ropes. And I'm terrified about the rope getting cut, as I should be. And Dave's like, we got it, man. It's in the bag. And I get up there and I go, how hard was it, cheese? He goes, oh, man, 10D, 10D. the only pitch he graded 10D, and Josh and Johnny graded it 11C. Cheeseman grades. But, you know, the beauty of the route for me now, and I remember a lot of it because it was such an intense experience, and, you know, moments of absolute intensity like the anchor failure, and when I snapped my tendon and took a 30-footer, and Dave got nailed in the thigh with a rock, and yeah, and then some of the breathtaking beauty of the whole thing. But really, I think the reason that I remember it so richly is because the last kind of big adventure I had with Dave, because in 87, you know, he lost his life on Mount Logan. And that was, you know, North Twin was the last really big alpine route that we did together, he and I, just off on this adventure. And it's the memories that I have of David, the man and my friend, that make North Twin so special for me.
Right.
And yeah, I think a lot of climbers who have been in the game for a long time and are lifers realize at some point that, you know, when it's early days, it's all about the grade and how hard you climb, how technically proficient you are, you know. Then it's where you're climbing, you know, are you climbing the Karakoram and the Himalaya and the Alps and the Andes and the Alaska Range and the St. Elias, all these exotic locations that have the biggest mountain faces. And then, you know, when you look back, really, it's who you climbed with. And that's the most important thing. And that's mm-hmm. what keeps things just so, so valuable and precious for you is right. the guys you did it with. Yeah.
Right. Like when you think about Dave, like what are the things that you most remember about him?
Oh, his enthusiasm, his drive, his desire, and then just his kind of, I don't know, he was a polymath in climbing. He was so good at pretty much all of it. And then his really special ability to know exactly where we were on the side of these big mountains. And, you know, that's just such a gift, because at any one time, if you ask an alpinist, okay, where are you right now exactly? We're so small, and mountain faces are so huge that they'll be able to give you approximation, but be able to pinpoint where you are in that mountainscape, that's a real gift. And Dave had that. And he was able to use that gift to orchestrate our ascents, to put out front or suggest or, he was a natural leader. You know, when we all went to Rakaposhi in 1984, and, you know, there was six of us, David was just the leader. And we all followed David's lead because we wanted to. We trusted him, and we were keen, you know. And I think I've said that that's probably a hallmark of a great leader. And there'll be people who write books all about that stuff. But I was with a great leader. And, you know, I could say a number of things that were the hallmarks of a great leader. But I think the biggest thing is I followed him and wanted to follow him kind of wholeheartedly, joyfully, and willingly. And I had a hell of a lot of fun doing it. So, yeah.
I appreciate you sharing that. You know, I'm reminded of, in preparing for this interview, I went back and I listened to the interview that I did with Carl Tobin, and, you know, I could hear like the emotion in Carl's voice when he thought back to the time that he got to spend with Dave. And the one of the things that Carl remarked was that when he remembers Dave is that Dave, he said, was cheery almost to a fault. And I wonder what do you think about that observation from Carl?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Yeah, very, uplifting personality. And always, I don't know, smile and laughing kind of guy. Although, you know, he had, you know, when things get serious, they get serious. So I got to see him and Carl, you know, in their moments of terror, right, like after the avalanche, avalanche on Fay. I didn't get to see Carl because he was 100 feet above us and thankfully still anchored to the ice after the avalanche passed, although he was white from helmet to crampon point. But, you know, I saw Dave's eyes, and they were the eyes of, you know, someone in the trenches who just had a really close explosion. You know, they're, you know, the iris completely surrounded by white, and it's abject terror and fear, and then coming down from that and having to deal. And then very soon after that, you know, there would be coming the jovial Cheeseman right then. Well, yes. Well, I guess, Barry, you will be out of the leading because your shoulder is hurt. So Carl will do the rest of the ice strip, and then I will take over on the rock. And then to see those two guys, you know, just joke back and forth. Yeah. Because they'd gotten so close on Deborah. And I think, you know, one of the regrets I have of my time with Dave Cheeseman was that, you know, back then, I would have been in my 20s. I just didn't have the wherewithal, ability, confidence to tell the guy that I loved him. And I did, you know, I love David, and I don't have a problem saying it now. Right. But I didn't have the ability to say it back then. So I wish I had had that back then and would have been able to tell him that, even though he probably would have laughed it off before he was, he died on a mountain.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, you know, just to maybe try and frame up, you know, kind of what a force he was to the Calgary or the Canadian community. I mean, what was that like for you and for the community when he died?
For me, you know, my knees crumpled and I just went to the ground when I heard about it. I was in Peru, actually. Yeah, as my friend Kevin would say, cut you off at the knees. It was just heartbreaking. And so much so because he had a young daughter and, of course, his dear wife, Jillian, who we all knew. And Saren was so young. I don't know if she has memories of her father, actually. So that is you know, especially as I'm a father now, it's really heartbreaking to think about that in those terms. It is always really heartwarming for me. And I don't get to see Saren a lot, but when I do, I can see David's face and her face. You know, it's just, it's so obvious that that's David's daughter. That, yeah, it's nice to see it because I can see David. And for Calgary, you know, it was a huge blow. As Urs Kalen put it, our Yoda, you know, that guy wasn't supposed to die. And yeah. Big hit, yeah. Me personally, I quit climbing for, oh, I don't know, 6 months, a year, something like that. And it was finally thinking about David and knowing that, you know, there was just something wild inside him that his businessman's three-piece suit couldn't tie up for long. He had to get out in the mountains. And, you know, I made a decision for myself that I would continue to climb too. And that was largely David's spirit that helped make that decision for me.
Right. I mean, this might be not an easy question to answer, but maybe it will be. But I'm curious, like, how do you see Dave's legacy and, like, his vision as an alpinist in today's climbers? Like, what do you think he kind of gave to the climbing world that still is there today?
Well, his legacy of ascents in the Rockies, you know, so many big faces that didn't have roots on them that now have Cheeseman roots on them that people return to and repeat, like the east face of Mount Assiniboine and the Andromeda Strain and North Twin, and, you know, I don't think anyone's been back to repeat the route on the South Good Sir, but the Emperor Face, and God, you know, just goes on. And he really brought the local kind of climbing community, especially with the nucleus of the Calgary Mountain Club, into, you know, the world stage of alpinism, and kind of showed that our mountain range, the Canadian Rockies, is the world stage of alpinism.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Barry's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his life and alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Part two of this series with Barry Blanchard will come out in another few weeks, and if you want to learn more about Barry's life in the Alpine, I would highly suggest picking up his book, The Calling, which is a modern mountaineering classic. You can find the book online at Patagonia, Amazon, or any other place good books are sold, and I'll make sure and leave some links in the show notes. Hey, if you enjoy listening to The Fern Line, make sure and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or better yet, become a monthly subscriber over on Patreon. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on this show, you can check out more of my music on Spotify, Apple Music, Bandcamp, or evanphillipsmusic.com. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line. 'Cause I ain't gonna stay here, I keep changing right by your side. That place.
They find